Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hi everyone, Connor here. If you don't know already, we have launched Intelligence Squared Premium. For bonus content, early access listens, and exclusive extras, just head to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the episode description. And if you're an Apple Podcast person, hit subscribe for the bonus extras from your podcasts app too. Thanks again for all your support. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Today on the podcast, we're asking why so many modern men are struggling. With 2 out of 3 deaths of despair, either from suicide or an overdose, affecting men, do we need to rethink masculinity? That's the argument of Richard Reeves, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies in the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., whose new book of Boys and Men, Why Modern Men Are Struggling, Why This Matters, and What to Do About It, states that both sides of the political divide are getting men wrong, and as a society we must address deep structural challenges that are affecting men. Our host for this episode is writer and critic Tamiwa Owolade. Here's Tamiwa with more.
Richard Reeves, in his new book, argues that the modern man and boy is struggling across 3 domains: in education, in employment, and as fathers. The first question for you, Richard, is why is the city of Kalamazoo in southwest Michigan so interesting for policy wonks?
I should say that Kalamazoo is also interesting to Glenn Miller fans. So those who know their Glenn Miller will know the famous song, I've Got a Girl in Kalamazoo. So if you've heard the name, my guess is unless you're a policy wonk, that's most likely that you will have heard of it. But it's interesting to policy wonks because it's a city that has had free college for all of its graduating high school seniors. So if you graduate from the high school in that city, then you can go to college pretty much anywhere in the state for free, full tuition paid. And it's also been very well evaluated. So it's a very generous free college scheme, but it's also been very well evaluated to see what effect it would have. What effect would it have on college completion in particular? And what the evaluators found was it had a massive effect on female college completion. So the young women in Kalamazoo became about 50% more likely to get a 4-year college degree, which was a huge change in terms of public policy terms. That's a massive impact. But for men, the number was 0. It had absolutely no impact on the likelihood of boys and then young men from that city going on to get a 4-year college degree. So the equivalent of a BA, 3-year college degree in the UK. And that's a pretty extraordinary fact. And that led me to look at a whole bunch of other interventions that find similar results, where you'll see pretty strong effects for girls or women and negative effects or 0 effect for boys or young men. And so in a way, that's one of the things that led me to write this book, because we know that there are some issues, say, in education for boys and men, but it's sort of rubbing salt in the wounds if then many of the interventions that are being tried to improve education overall are helping girls and women, but not helping boys and men.
Hmm. So when does this gap in education start between boys and girls, and what are the possible causes for it?
It starts at the beginning, basically. I mean, you can't really find a point in the education
from
system.
Birth.
Well, that's a good question. You said it depends when you think education starts, I suppose. I don't know of any particularly good evidence for differences in skills, say, among 2-year-olds. There are differences in behavior among two-year-olds. So like two-year-old boys are much more physically aggressive, for example, than two-year-old girls and have to be taught not to do that, which is kind of probably evidence that some of that's natural, but that maybe that's a subject we'll get onto, Tom. But essentially from the beginning, at least from when we start measuring it, right? So as soon as we measure it when they start school and then we measure it again, you know, say at the start of secondary school and then again at the end of GCSEs, A-levels, etc. And essentially the gap runs in favor of girls every step of the way. It does get wider at certain points and narrow other points. So it seems to be a little bit wider at the beginning, maybe narrows a little bit up into the early teen years, and then it widens again quite dramatically during the teen years. And so it's pretty wide by the time you get to the end of secondary school.
Yeah. And what do you think? What are the possible causes for this gap?
So I think there's a number of possible speculations here. I think the main ones are that on average, and maybe we should just preface that almost everything I'm going to say is on average, so I don't have to say it every time because that'd get boring. And the distributions overlap. Can we take that as given?
Sure. Right?
And then maybe edit that in later. But on average, boys develop a little bit more slowly. They develop later than girls. Mm. And that's especially true in adolescence because girls hit puberty earlier. And one of the things that does, it triggers the development of parts of the brain, especially the prefrontal cortex, which is, that's the bit of your brain that says, do your physics homework, don't go to the party. That's the bit of your brain that says you should study for these tests rather than just turn up and hope for the best. It's the bit of your brain that says, if I don't do well in these exams, I won't go to college and then I'll struggle in life. So it's future orientation. And that bit of the brain just develops about a year or two earlier in girls. And so if you have an education system that rewards those sorts of behaviors, which we do, then we should be surprised if girls weren't ahead. The surprise is that they weren't ahead all along. And the reason they weren't ahead all along is because of sexism. It actually, under conditions where girls and women were actively discouraged from pursuing education, especially higher education, then the natural advantages they had in the education system couldn't be seen. So it's paradoxical that it took the women's movement to expose the ways in which the education system is structured in favor of girls and women, including in this timing way. The other two I'll just mention briefly is, one is that teaching is becoming a more female profession over time, and there's some evidence that having male teachers can be particularly beneficial for boys. And so that could be a part of it too. And then the last is that the boys on average tend to do better with more vocational forms of learning than girls. But most of our spending on education still goes on traditional education. So things like apprenticeships, vocational training, doesn't get the same investments. And so that tends to hurt boys a bit more.
And is this education gap true across the world, or is it true in certain countries?
It's true in all advanced economies.
Sure.
So like one data point would be in every OECD country. Mm. So to the extent that you're economically advanced enough to be in the OECD, then there are more young women than young men with a college degree. Mm. In every OECD country. I think the last across the line might be Mexico, but someone can fact check that for me in real time. But interestingly, even outside the OECD, so like a number of striking number of Middle Eastern countries and so on, you are seeing a gender gap in favor of women at some levels. But it's obviously not true in many of the poorer parts of the world. And so one of the difficulties with this conversation is that the ways in which women and girls are outpacing boys and men are quite local. So it is typically in advanced economies that we're mostly talking about, and recent. It's only happened in the last few decades. It's happened spectacularly quickly, but it's happened very recently. And so we wouldn't be having this conversation 40 years ago, and we wouldn't be having it still in probably half the countries in the world.
Sure. What is redshirting?
Redshirting is it's a US term borrowed from athletics, which is to delay entry to school for a year or delay entry to a secondary school for a year. So you basically enter whatever the school year is a year older. And it used to be done mostly for athletic reasons. So in the US, it was very often done, and this is particularly true for male sports, but just being bigger and stronger was going to be to your advantage. So actually, you know, being 19 is helpful when you're playing a contact sport than being 18. Everything else equal, you can be bigger and you've got a bit more time to train. But now it's been used as a term for academic redshirting. So that's that's the decision to delay entry into school, not because you want your kid to be the best football player or whatever, or rugby player, but because you want them to do better at math and better at English and do better in their exams. And so that's really now the main driver of what this quote's redshirting phenomenon.
Interesting. In the book, you argue, of course, that the differences between boys and girls or men and women, which explains the differences in terms of education, is at least partly because of biology. So what would you say to somebody that says, by insisting on the importance of biology, you are merely endorsing something that's been used historically to oppress women?
Well, it depends. It depends what mood I was in. So let's say I'm in a conciliatory mood and I'm in a public event. Mm. You know, so I'm going to say I totally understand where you're coming from. that is absolutely no, etc. The truth is, I'd say, are you crazy? Mm. Mm. Like if I'm being candid about it, and it's, you know, it's just you and me. It's just you and me, right? So I can only see you. I can only see you on the screen. So let's assume it's just you and me. Yeah. I think nobody out there in the real world thinks that there aren't some biological differences that have some consequences for things like education. No one who's raised boys or been a boy or met a boy thinks that there aren't some of these differences. The real debate is not whether there are differences. It's like how big they are. Mm. In what domains and how much they matter. That's the real debate. And actually, problem with the whole debate about male and female brains is that it's kind of focused on adults, by which time most of the differences have actually washed out by the time you get to your mid-20s and going forward. What that disguises is the biggest differences in the timing of brain development, which we just discussed, which does have significant implications for education, right? So even if you don't think there's much difference in male and female brains among 28-year-olds, which there isn't much difference, and not very consequential, that doesn't mean it's true for 14 and 15-year-olds. And there's no disagreement among neuroscientists at all. The question is how far it overlaps. So I'd say, and the last thing I'll say on this is the thing I find quite frustrating about this debate is acknowledging that nature has a role doesn't make culture less important. Mm. It makes it more important because culture is what determines how and whether and when we express some of these natural differences. So to acknowledge nature is not to deny culture. It is to elevate culture. In that sense, it's a completely false binary. Mm,
yeah. And do you think the factors that explain why boys are struggling in schools relative to girls also explains why men are struggling in employment relative to women? Or is it something different going on?
It's mostly something different. So to the extent that boys who struggle in education are going to find it harder in the labor market, and especially now, so that's a factor. But the main thing that's hit male employment and male wages has been external shocks to the economy. So more free trade, globalization, and more automation, right? And that's nothing to do with the rise of women in the labor market and nothing to do with brain development and not directly anything to do with the education system, except to the extent that we now need to prepare men for this new world. But actually, it's just what's happened is that traditionally male jobs have just been hit hard by industrialization and free trade. That's just a fact. And the question then is how quickly can men adapt to the new world? And so I think that it's very important to realize that things can happen at the same time without necessarily being the cause of the other. So, for example, the rise of women in the labor market has happened at the same time that men have been hit in the labor market. But it's not because women have risen that men have fallen. Other things have happened at the same time, and in particular, deindustrialization.
And do you think the struggles of men in the labor system is one of the most important factors that explain populism?
I think that the real difficulties that many men are having, right, and especially I think it's important not to say this is not all men, right? This is not typically the men at the top who are actually on most measures doing pretty well, but working class men, let's use that term broadly, the real problems that they are having, if unaddressed, or in some cases even unacknowledged, create fertile ground for populist movements. To the extent that populism gets its fuel from grievance, gets its fuel from reaction, the extent that it's reactionary, then I think that unaddressed male problems are really, they are just great fuel for the populist fire. And I think we've seen that. I think we've seen, like, particularly among young Britons, for example, quite a big gender gap on Brexit. And there's a huge gender gap over here in the US from Donald Trump's victory. The rise of the right in East Germany is strongly related to what's happening to a lot of East German men. And so I think that the gender dimension to populism is a strong one and isn't talked about enough. We know about class, and of course that's probably even more important, but I think this gender element is huge. But I don't think it has to be. I think that what's happened is, because we haven't addressed the problems square on in the mainstream, that's created space for more reactionary populists to sort of pick up on that. Because there are, you know, if you have real problems that responsible people don't address, then irresponsible people are going to exploit them. That's a fact of human history, I think. And I think we're seeing that playing out in this space now.
Yeah. But why do you think the progressive left view this topic as a zero-sum game? So they would say that focusing on the unique struggles of boys and men potentially distracts us from being feminist. Why do they see it in such terms?
I think that, again, in a generous mood, I would say that it's because it's happened so fast.
Mm.
I mean, it's happened so unbelievably quickly that updating your priors that quickly is just really hard. I mean, the cause of gender equality has basically been synonymous with the cause of women and girls for, I don't know, let's say 10,000 years, and has only ceased to be so for, let's say, 30, 40 years. So we're talking about the blink of an eye. And there are many remaining challenges for women and girls. And so I just think it's really hard to catch up with such a dramatic social change. And when you have a situation where we've already talked about the education gaps, but, you know, 40% of British households now have a female breadwinner. And that's just I don't know what the number was 40 years ago, but it's probably quadrupled. It's certainly just like, it's a different world, even to the world I grew up in. You know, I'm only in my early 50s. So this is just an extraordinarily rapid change. And I think there's a sense that, like, there's only so much political capital to go around. There's only so much money to go around, right? If we spend this on boys, then it means we're going to spend less of it on girls and women. But what I would say is that in the long run, when boys and men are struggling, that tends to end up not helping women either.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. So we've spoken about what the progressive left get wrong about the unique struggles faced by boys and men. What would you say the conservative right, or do they get wrong on this issue?
Well, it's a couple of things. I mean, one is, we talked a bit about biology, and we've just had a discussion where, like, there are some biological differences, like, which is outside of, like, some circles were like, well, duh. But the right will sometimes then overemphasize those. And so there's a tendency, I think, to explain gender inequalities too quickly by resort to a biological explanation. That's, of course, an old story. And so there's a loss of nuance there. But I'd say the biggest thing is probably what David Willetts once described as a tendency among conservatives towards bring-backery, which is a great phrase, bring-backery. I don't think I managed to get that into the book. That was from his book about, you know, generational inequality from quite a few years back now. And what he means by that is, like, conservatives are like, we need to bring back X. We need to bring back the traditional family, bring back traditional manufacturing jobs, bring back whatever it is, right? Bring back X. And I think that when it comes to this issue, too often what conservatives will do is to suggest that we can bring back the traditional family. And we can't. That's in the rearview mirror now. The women's movement has successfully created a world in which women have much more economic independence, which is a glorious, wonderful thing, arguably the biggest human, you know, the biggest liberation in human history on some measures. But that means you can't put Humpty back together again. You can't rebuild family on the basis of women's economic dependency on men. That world has gone. And so the trouble is that if you just talk about traditional families, traditional jobs, manufacturing, etc., what you're really doing is you're just holding out false hope. And that doesn't help men adapt. What we actually need to do is help men adapt to the world as it is, rather than the world as it was. And conservatives almost always fail to do that.
What does HEAL mean? H-E-A-L. What does that mean?
Yes, it's an acronym. You know, you need a good acronym, as everyone knows, but you can't get anywhere, especially in policy circles, without an acronym. And this one is like the mirror image of STEM. So most people heard of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Interesting. What most people don't know is that it wasn't originally STEM. When Judith Ramelay went to the National Institutes of Health, it was actually SMET, S-M-E-T, and she said, oh, I don't like the sound of that. I'm going to change it. So she changed it to STEM. And honestly, the rest is history. We had STEM caucuses. There's been a huge push to get women, especially into STEM jobs, pretty successfully. HEAL is the opposite of that. So it's health, education, administration, and literacy. Literacy skills as opposed to math skills as you get in STEM. And those jobs, if we talk about them, jobs account for a huge and growing part of the economy. Like we have growing needs for people in those sorts of jobs, obviously for teachers, but also for healthcare workers, social care workers, people whose jobs are more on the administrative side rather than perhaps the machine side, a bit more relational, etc., and requiring all kinds of literacy skills, like how many... You can go back in time and find jobs where you didn't really have even to talk to somebody very much during the course of the day. And those were very often male jobs, but that's much less true now. And so those skills, those so-called soft skills, are becoming more important in the labor market. And that's where the jobs are coming from too.
Yeah. So how precisely can we get boys into those jobs? Boys and young men.
Yeah, boys, I'm glad you added that. And so it's a bit of a vicious circle because as those professions either remain or in some cases become more gender segregated, become more female in orientation, it's harder to persuade people. Like my own son actually works in early years childcare, but that's like, it's very hard to find male childcare workers. I was looking at the numbers for the UK recently, and there were almost no male childcare workers in the UK. In fact, they couldn't find a single one in the whole of Northern Ireland.
Wow.
Not one. It's like literally none, and very few anywhere else. And so it's very hard then to persuade men to go into it. So you have to reduce the stigma. But the only way to do that is, as obviously, you need good role models. We need male nurses and social workers and teachers and psychologists going into schools. We need outreach programs, just as we've done for women into STEM. Yeah, we've worked really hard to persuade girls that STEM careers are for them. We need exactly the same zeal to persuade boys and men that those professions, the HEAL professions, are for them. But I also think we probably need some more aggressive action, like some scholarships specifically aimed at men to go into those professions, just as we've done for women into STEM.
In terms of, because many young men and boys will see those professions as emasculating, so how can we get rid of that stigma?
Yeah, well... As I say, to some extent, what I think we need some blunt policy tools to try and increase male representation. So there's a great line, like, which includes scholarships, subsidies, bribes, a lot of money spent on it and so on, to try and just move them, get more men into them, right? So initially, I think we're just going to have to like throw some money at that issue to get more men in. Then the stigma will lessen just because there are more men doing it. But there's a great phrase from the women's movement is, you have to see it to be it.
Sure.
And so I just think how we present role models around that is hugely important. And so just think about popular culture. Think about the ways in which we depict those roles. Actually, advertising and TV is actually more gender stereotypical about professions even than the real world is. And I think the last thing I'll say is that what we don't want to do is signal that these jobs are... That somehow make them seem more masculine than they really are, or more feminine than they really are. We just have to be pretty straightforward about it. Like nursing's a good career, reasonably secure, etc. We don't have to sort of go overboard in sort of making it somehow seem macho to be a nurse. We just need to make it seem not as you said, not effeminate to be a nurse.
Yeah.
And so how we talk about it's hugely important.
Just a reminder, you can support Intelligence Squared and get even closer to the world's most brilliant minds by signing up for Intelligence Squared Premium. Head to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the description to get started. And Apple folks, we've got you covered too. Hit subscribe for some bonus extras on your podcast app. Thanks for all your support. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Why do we need more black men in particular to be teachers?
Well, we need more men, period. And I think that's important. But we need more black men because there is very strong evidence that for black boys in particular, having a black male teacher has some really positive effects. I would say it's probably true for Hispanic boys as well in the US at least. And there are even fewer Hispanic male teachers, actually. Lots more Hispanic female teachers, but not many more Hispanic male teachers. And so I do think a kind of, if we think about gender and race, you know, you have to see it to be it. And in particular, because black boys are, and this is a big difference in the US and the UK, actually. You know, black boys are the ones who are pretty much at the bottom of all of these distributions in terms of education. They are the ones who are struggling most in education. And the gender gap is huge. So already for every one college degree a black man gets, two black women get a college degree. And so that, you know, so we're already at 2-1 for black men and black women. So the gender gaps are much bigger there. And so we need a concerted focus on black boys and men in particular. In the UK, the story is more strongly one of class, and where you see much more kind of class really plays in much more strongly.
With that in mind, how would you respond to the claim made by many people that espouse what's known as intersectionality, which is that black women in particular face the most struggles in society? Because what you seem to be arguing is that it's actually black men and black boys rather than black women and black girls. How would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I'd just get out some charts and some data. And I've already alluded to some of them. So, well, you're not looking at the same data as I am. I mean, black women in the US are more upwardly mobile out of poverty than any other group. Certainly than black men are the least. Mm. Black women are the breadwinner in most households. I've already mentioned some of the education. Actually, among young Americans, there are slightly more young black women with a postgraduate degree than young white men. With a postgraduate degree. And so there's been this extraordinary... Now, it's not to suggest that it's job done for black women, but on most of the dimensions you care to look at, you will find that black men, black boys and men, are doing significantly worse on a lot of the measures we might care about than black girls and women. To me, that is intersectionality applied properly, because what it does is it said you can't assume that the position of one group over another is somehow fixed for all time, right? So if you don't assume white always above black, male always above female, straight always above gay, etc., because that will vary, right? It will vary over time as to what that means. Now, as a general proposition, we know that those things are kind of mostly true. But then scramble it up and then add class, right? Scramble it up. And what intersectionality does is it scrambles those categories and allows you to look with more precision at particular groups.
Yeah. And in terms of being fathers as well, can you envisage a future in which the stay-at-home dad becomes as normalized as the stay-at-home mom?
I'll be honest and say it's hard to envisage it right now. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the direction we should be traveling in. The only thing, and it's one of the reasons why is it the
direction we should be traveling in?
Because of the evidence that fathers actually matter as much to their kids' welfare and well-being as mothers, and in some ways, and in some slightly different and complementary ways, again on average. And also because, like, I tend to write about this, and I make this mistake, I think, in the book too, of just looking at it through the lens of kids, right? What matters to kids, right? So fathers, I just did it then, fathers matter to kids. But also being a parent, being an engaged parent, is massively important to the identity and purpose and meaning of people's lives. And so if you deny that to anybody, mothers, fathers, except then that's a huge loss. And so I now think it's actually important to think about this from the point of view of men. And so I just think as a signal also to the next generation. The only caveat I'll add to that is I'm reasonably convinced by the evidence that dads really seem to come into their own in adolescence. It's not that they don't matter up until that point, but they seem to have particular value to add for teenagers. And so if anything, it might go slightly the other way for really young kids. So like, just to say it much more bluntly than I would kind of in the book, but it's like, all right, it's like 1-year-olds might be with mum, but like 12-year-olds should probably be with dad.
Why is that?
I'd like to see is much more. Well, it seems to be that once you get to your teenage years, you're sort of really pushing at the envelope. You're taking more risks. You're going out in the world, etc. And it looks as if whereas when you're very young, it's more about nurturing, right? So when you're really young, you just need to, right? You need nurture and you need to be kept. Like you only need to know like two people, like one, whatever. You're not out there making networks. You're not partying. But as you get into teenage years, especially more deeply into adolescence, you're basically learning how to grow into the world and take risks. And it looks as if fathers have something of a competitive advantage when it comes to helping their kids learn how to manage risk, get out there in the world, learn how to be more independent. And so it looks as if dads might be a little bit better at helping. Again, I'll simplify horribly, but it's like if mums are really good at like keeping the kids safe in the nest, dads are pretty good at helping them to successfully get out of the nest. Again, these are averages, but and so what that means is that parental leave should be available to both, but it should be available throughout childhood. There's a bit of an early years determinism sometimes, like it's game over by five. We are learning much more that adolescence is just as important as the early years, but it's really neglected in public policy, and I think sometimes it's neglected by parents too.
The book is very policy heavy, and a lot of your solutions are very policy based.
I'm going to take that as a compliment.
It is okay? A compliment, but there's a but okay. coming as well. There is a but coming. Is there something to be said about trying to cultivate ways of improving men which are not necessarily based on public policy. So, for example, we know that men tend to be lonelier than women. Boys often tend to have fewer friends than girls. They tend to have worse social skills. Can we cultivate certain sorts of civic institutions in which we can socialize men, boys, I should say, or even men as well? Because many teenage boys and young men, and this might sound like a stereotype, but I don't think it is necessarily, spend a lot of their times playing video games excessively, watching lots of porn, basically isolated from society. And yeah, you can have a lot of policy sort of solutions, but is there something more granular and more something that we can do from a more societal and organic base to improve? Is there something religion can do, for example? Is there something social clubs can do? I'm just thinking of anything that's more sort of organic and more bottom up rather than policy based.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is, I think some of those problems you've identified, probably more among men, are actually symptoms of some of the problems that I'm trying to address through policy, right? Sure. So I think if you're like, if you can create more engaged fatherhood and you can encourage that through public policy, I'm not suggesting for a moment that like, oh, you know, policy, problem solved. You know, I used to work at IPPR back in the day, and that's how, you know, you spend too much time with think tankers, that's how you end up thinking. It's just like the right solution and everything will be. So that's not true, of course, especially when they're more cultural. But policy can certainly help and it can signal. So if we had more engaged fathers, if we had more men in employment, more, you know, et cetera, then I think that some of those problems are symptoms of some of the economic, social, and educational challenges that men and boys are facing. That said, and look, as a policy wonk, I wanted to spend time in areas that I thought there could be some tractable problems, some problems for which there were policy solutions. Right? A lot of the books that are written about boys and men are like the Book of Lamentations. And I didn't, you know, I really wanted to have more solutions. But that said, I do think that culturally, actually caring for boys and men, but especially for boys, does mean making sure that they're empowered, making sure that, you know, that they're being socially cared for. The default assumption that they're kind of they're just okay and we should focus on the girls is not only wrong, but if anything, might be the opposite of the truth, right? Boys, if anything, seem to be a bit more sensitive to their environment. And so I think encouraging like more, let's call it like socialization, but more opportunities to make friends, draw on skills, develop your confidence, like out of school clubs, maybe like churches, etc. So, you know, I'm speaking about my, I'm a liberal scholar at the Brookings Institution. One of the most important institutions in my life has been the scouting movement. I was a scout, came through scouts. I then became a scout leader. My boys went to scouts. And so, and that was not at school. It was a very different set of skills, but it was also about bonding and forming different kinds of friendships in different environments. And I think that kind of activity is hugely important for everybody, but let's go out on a limb and suggest that some of them, at least right now, might be even more important for our boys than they are for our girls. And so to the extent that we've got less of that, those activities, that might explain some of this retreat we see among men. It's not so much, and I'll say that it's not, I'm much less worried about the men who are acting out because they're small in number, although they get the headlines, and sometimes tragically so. I'm much more worried about the ones who are checking out. I think that's the, I think a much bigger problem is passivity and retreat and dislocation and checking out. And that's why I'm not so worried about video games and porn in and of themselves. I don't see much evidence for harm there. What I'm worried about is if they're displacing other activities.
Sure, sure. What would you say is the most provocative argument in your book, if any?
I just think it's all plain common sense. Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, how could anyone disagree? It depends to whom, but I would say it's probably the idea that the education system is structurally favoring girls and women, that they're just the design, the way the education system works is not just gender neutral, it's actually structured. There is that it's structured, to put it more negatively. It's structured against boys and men in ways we couldn't see some before. And I think that's a really, really provocative thought for some people to get past. Yeah. They're like, really? How can that be right? but I think it is. I think it's true.
But when you say that it's structurally like sort of geared against boys, would you say that's deliberate?
No.
Okay.
No, I think that's a really important. Yeah. I should have said that. So thank you for asking me that. No, because after all, the education system was basically designed by men.
Mm.
And so it seems unlikely that 100 years ago, a bunch of men sat around and designed a school system that much later, once we'd removed the artificial barriers to women and girls, would be bad for boys. No. I think it's completely inadvertent. I think it's just, and as I said, I think it was just disguised before by the fact that, you know, under conditions of sexism, then you couldn't actually see that intrinsic advantage that girls and women had. But it's interesting, if you look at, like, if you go back to the 70s when there was a lot of arguments going on in favor of women and girls getting, you know, what can we do to help more women and girls do better in education? What nobody predicted was that not just that girls and women would catch up, but they would blow right past and keep going until the gender inequality became as wide, but in the other direction. Nobody predicted that. And first of all, that means that psychologically we're not ready for that world. But it also, I think, reflects the fact that nobody took seriously the possibility that if we leveled the playing field, what it would show is that the girls were much better players.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what's happened. They're just at a natural advantage in the current education system. But as I say, not deliberately, not intentionally in any way at all.
Sure. Because when we think of the word structural, we tend to think it's a sort of
deliberate.
A conspiracy, basically,
structural racism in the US is typically associated with things like obviously going all the way back to slavery, but also like redlining, so not allowing, you know, black families to buy homes in certain parts of the city, the GI Bill excluding below black folks. It was, so you're right that what comes with that is a sense of intent, and actually is quite important to my argument. This is actually helpful to me, because when I talk about structural disadvantages in lots of areas of life, I'm not implying intent.
Mm.
You could say the same about the labor market. So to the extent that the structure of the labor market has changed in ways that are actually disfavoring men now, was that deliberate? Like, did anybody, were any of the people, including myself, who were in favor of free trade or more immigration, were they somehow thinking, yeah, this will really hurt the men? Mm. No. But it allows me to make a broader point, which is big social and economic changes, even when they're positive, can bring with them some side effects that are not positive, right? And so we have a responsibility, even when the overall change has been positive, to deal with some of the side effects too. So in the case of globalization, it means helping working class men, especially who've been dislocated. In the case of changes in the role of fathers, it means helping fathers to keep having a role in the family, even though their role as main breadwinner might not be there anymore.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Head to iq2premium.supercast.com for even more content made just for our premium listeners, including extended Q&As, event discounts, and our newsletter too. Thanks for being a part of Intelligence Squared.